know, the battery goes dead and then it costs you $800 to replace the battery. You know, you want to pull your hair out, it's always the battery. Okay, so for historical reasons, mainly because I wanted to have my own project that I could do in my own lab. I didn't want to compete with Otto Friesen and Bill Kristan, who were going to work on swimming. I wanted to have something I would do myself. So I hit upon this pattern generator that controls the heartbeat. And this, I'll just give you, I'm going to talk a lot about the work of, this is my current lab here, and these are some former people in the lab. And I'm going to talk especially about the work of Angela Venning, and maybe I might get to Daniel Quay also. And these are my postdocs in my lab right now. I'll also talk a lot about my last graduate student, Michael Wright, and my work with my collaborator, Brian Norris, who spends his summers in my lab. I'll give you now, I'll give you another perspective. So why in the 70s were we excited to study these pattern generators in invertebrates? Well, the answer comes in many different ways. Consider that your nervous system consists of 10 to the 11th neurons, right? That's a lot. You know, maybe it's 10 to the 10th, maybe it's 10 to the 11th. There's a little bit of controversy about it is, but let's say 10 to the 11th. The leech has 10 to the 4th, right? So that's a big difference in the number of nerve cells that you have to study to get it. So that's one of the things. We said, well, there are very few nerve cells, so if we're studying these basic patterns, we can get some ideas of how the neuronal networks will work. The other thing that makes these preparations very, very appealing is things like this. This is a ganglion from the midbody of the leech. And if you put it, you can dissect it out and put it in a dish like this, and it contains the entire neuronal network that controls one segment of the animal. And each one of these ganglia is very similar to each other one. And as you can see, the neurons are big. Even the small ones are pretty big. They're 15 microns across. And they're in stereotypical positions within the ganglia. So I can tell you with certainty that these are the giant serotonergic neurons that control excitability in the ganglion. And this is a pressure sensory neuron. And this is a pressure sensory neuron. This one goes to the dorsal skin. This one goes to the ventral skin. So I can tell you all about these neurons. We can identify the neurons by their characteristic positions within the ganglion. And every time we go in, we'll see them. The ones that I work on are this one. These are motor neurons that innervate the heart, and this one. These are interneurons that control those motor neurons. So we know where they are, we know where they live, and we can go and work on them.
Is there a typical length of those neurons?
Their diameter is, the largest is about 70 to 80 microns. That's this one. And this one here that I work on is about 15. Oh, the length. You want to know the length. Well, some of them are fairly local. But this neuron, for example, the one that sits in the third ganglion of that type, sends an axon all the way down to the 18th ganglion. So in a long leech, that's about that long. They have an axon about that long. So they extend for a large number of segments sometimes. The interneurons do. The motor neurons are local. They will send an axon out the nerve in their own ganglion and innervate the muscle in that ganglion. And they don't tend to go communicate between ganglia. You'll see a little of their morphology in a bit. So let me give you the gross anatomy. Here is, I hate this. All right. So here is a cartoon of the leech, and here are these ganglia that are all in a chain. Packets of 400 neurons that connect to one another by bundles of axons that we call connectives. And they control their segment. Now at the front end, there is some of the ganglia are fused together, and we call that the head ganglia. There are four fused together up here. And down at the rear, there are seven fused together. Okay? And don't think they think with their tails, because in fact, they're also reduced back here. So this is the rear sucker, and it holds on to things. This is the front sucker. This is where it bites you. So, and each one of these ganglia controls its segment. So here's one of them, right here, and here's another one. This nerve cord sits inside a blood vessel, and it's bathed in blood, so it doesn't have any vascularization or much covering, because it's protected within this vessel. We can open that vessel and expose it, the ganglion, and keep it in a simple saline solution. And this ganglion innervates this segment of the leech. All the muscles, and it shows you the different muscle types here. These are the muscles that are involved in swimming, the longitudinal muscles, and these, the flattener muscles. And then these are oblique muscles, and these are circular muscles, and they do so. So all the muscles are controlled by this, and all the sensory information comes in to the ganglion from that segment right there. And this is the circulatory system, the main blood vessels. And this vessel, which runs the entire length of the animal from one end to the other, and they connect at the front and at the back, this is a contractile vessel. It constricts rhythmically to move blood through the animal. And that's the pattern of activity that I've been looking at. And you can imagine that because each segment is controlled by its own ganglion, then we have to coordinate all the motor neurons together. We have to produce a basic rhythm, and then we have to coordinate all the motor neurons. And they have to be coordinated so they produce a precise pattern. You can't have them all the segments constricting at once. In fact, you need a peristaltic wave, as we'll see, and to move blood forward. And then when blood comes into these vessels, after being propelled forward, it goes into the capillaries. Okay, so I showed you the ganglion. And now the other way that we can identify cells is by their characteristic morphology. Here is one of the neurons filled with a dye, and then we've reconstructed it here. And this is one of the interneurons that control the motor neurons in the third ganglion. We're recording from it. Here it's in blue. Here's the interneuron, the corresponding interneuron in the second ganglion. They look a little different, but they have the same basic structure. The cell body, a loop, the axon goes rearward. Cell body, a loop, the axon goes rearward. So this is the guy that will go all the way down to the 18th segment, okay? And these axons do that. Now, you see this neuron, it comes down and it has fine branches that interact with this neuron. And that's where these two neurons make their interaction. So this neuron inhibits this one, and this one inhibits this one, and that's where they do it. In every segment that they have an axon, they will also have these fine branches to make their connections. And so we know the neurons by their characteristic morphology. We can always fill them with a dye. And they also have this characteristic activity. So this is there's no other cells in the ganglion that do this. They produce these bursts of action potentials, about 40 action potentials in this neuron in a burst. And they do this over and over again with a period of about 6 to 8 seconds. So they rhythmically produce this. And notice that this neuron here is alternating with this neuron. They alternate. So they strictly alternate. So we can identify the neurons. So that's why we use invertebrates. We can identify the neurons. And when we started this, this was pre the days when you could label specific neurons with GFP and identify neurons in vertebrates. It's still a very difficult thing to do, to know, because there is still heterogeneity in the neurons, but this was the big appeal of this preparation. Then, you've seen this if you came to my other talk, but I'll show it to you anyway here. I always do this. All right, so here is a leech that's been pinned out over a clear resin, and here would be the front. Here's segment 8, 9, and 10, and this is the right heart, and this is the left heart. You can't see the left heart because it's in systole, and there's no blood on it, and here you see the right heart filled with blood. By the way, this is the nerve cord here sitting inside that ventral blood vessel. See a ganglion here, a ganglion here, and a ganglion here. So you can imagine that it comes out and innervates the heart. So let's look at this. And then you'll see why this particular pattern generator intrigued me. So let's look at this heart first. It pumps a lot of blood forward by constricting in a peristaltic wave. The other heart is constricting more or less synchronously, but blood appears to move rearward. Now, this heart has become peristaltic and is moving a lot of blood forward, and this heart becomes synchronous and it moves a little blood, okay? The synchronous heart moves blood into the peripheral circulation associated with the kidneys of the leech, which are called nephridia, and the peristaltic heart propels the blood and provides the systolic pressure needed to perfuse the capillaries. So, and every 40 beats, these switch roles. So it became a very interesting pattern to look at. And here's then our evidence for a central pattern generator. So here we recorded from the nerves that go out to innervate the heart that contain the axons of the motor neurons that innervate the heart, and in an isolated nervous system. So the heart was removed, everything was removed, just the nervous system and this fine nerve, we record from it. And we did that in the left 10th, 7th, 5th, and 4th segments. And you can see that they follow a progression. The motor neuron fires first in 10, then in 7, then in 5, then in 4, over and over again. That's peristaltic. And then, boom, precipitously, they switch, and now all the motor neurons fire together. Okay, so this is evidence then that the central nervous system can produce this pattern of activity that you see in the animal. And we now know that there are 7 pairs of interneurons, and we color code them so that we can make our records easier. And those 7 pairs of interneurons are responsible for controlling the motor neurons. Here. There are motor neurons in the 3rd through 18th segment, and there are interneurons in the 1st through 7. And some of the interneurons make connections to the motor neurons shown in this circuit diagram. And these connections are all inhibitory. Every one of these connections from the interneurons to the motor neurons are inhibitory. We call these premotor interneurons because they directly connect to motor neurons. These are premotor also. We call these the middle ones, and we call these the front ones. And then these other neurons participate in generating the rhythm, but do not contact motor neurons. Okay, and then and it's taken a long time to work this out, to map all these connections. Then what we've done is, in this diagram, we've lumped together neurons that have similar input and output connections. So 3 inhibits the 3 on the other side of the ganglion, 4 inhibits the 4 on the other side of the ganglion, both 3 and 4, inhibit 1 and 2 on the same side, and 1 and 2 inhibit 3 and 4 on the same side. They 3 and 4 feed forward inhibition to 5, and 5 feeds forward bilateral inhibition to 6 and 7. This is an excitatory connection that's electrical from 3 to 4 to 6 to 7. So that's what we know about the connections. And to work out this kind of a connection diagram for a central pattern generator has only been done in a few preparations. The stomatogastric ganglion of crustacea, some of the insect systems that are large insects like locusts, but I think there are only very few where we really know the connections. And then this shows a little bit about how the motor neurons are controlled. In this case, we're recording from these two neurons. They're green, and one on the right side, one on the left side, and we're recording from this motor neuron. And so you see that this motor, actually we're recording from this motor neuron because of the right side. But you see that when this interneuron fires action potentials, the motor neuron is inhibited strongly. And then when it stops firing, the motor neuron comes up and fires action potentials, and that causes a constriction of the heart. All right? So that would that's how the interneurons pace the motor neurons. They produce this rhythmic bursting activity in an isolated nervous system that times the beat of the heart. Okay, so every time this motor neuron fires a burst, the heart would constrict. So these neurons are the pacemakers for the activity of the entire network, and they control the beat timing. So let's look at those neurons. Here's the pair in three. They produce this alternating bursting activity, and I'd like to spend some time on how they do that, so I can give you all a little bit new stuff from what I did before. And you can see that they alternate very precisely. And they are the timers for the beat rhythm. And here you see them again. And I just want to point out, because it kind of illustrates what we're doing. We're recording in an isolated ganglion these two neurons. They make inhibitory connections, mutually inhibitory connections, and they produce this rhythm of activity. And that paces the whole beat. And this is just to show you that we can record from these neurons in two different ways. The conventional way, which is to record with an intracellular electrode where you see all the synaptic potentials and the action potentials, or this is a way we invented where we just put an electrode over the cell body and just record the action potentials. This has the advantage that we can do it for hours. So I want to kind of, and as I said, it's really the reciprocal connections between these two pairs of interneurons that sets up the basic rhythm. And then how are they controlled? Well, that's shown here. You see that the heart interneurons in ganglion 2, 3, and 4 all recorded simultaneously on the same side. And what you see here is that 3 and 4 fire roughly together. The 4 usually leads by a little bit. In fact, almost always leads by a little bit. But 3 and 4 roughly fire together, and the 1s and 2s would fire in the gaps. And it's the 1s and 2s that hold these two little oscillators together and coordinates them. That's why we call them coordinating neurons. So then we did a bunch of recordings to see what all the different premotor interneurons do, and you see that they have two basic patterns. One is the peristaltic, one is the synchronous, and they regularly switch. And notice that the front interneurons, these, do not move in any way during a switch. They just go along, oblivious of the switch, It's these guys that switch, that change their activity with respect to these front guys. Notice the four leads three by a slight amount before the switch and after the switch. But look what happens to the sixes and sevens. The seven first leads the six, and now it follows it, right? So they switch, and they are switched by these neurons here. And we can see that here when you record from two of these neurons intracellularly, you see that one is bursting with lots of action potentials and rhythmic inhibition that come from these two cells. The other one is silent and is rhythmically inhibited by these two cells. But then when a switch occurs, they change roles. And that changes the conformation of the network from this to this. And that's what causes a switch. And you can see that here in this diagram where Brian Norris in the lab managed to record from a 3, a 7, a 3, a 7, and both 5s. All right? So he's recording from all these neurons together, and you see that on the side of the inactive hard interneuron 5, that you have the peristaltic coordination of the interneurons. On the side of the active one, you have the synchronous coordination. When they switch roles, then this side becomes synchronous and this side becomes peristaltic. So that's how the switch works, and so we can say that the network exists in these two different configurations. And then these premotor neurons put that pattern onto the motor neurons and coordinate them. And here you can see that in this recording, where we record from all the premotor interneurons and two motor neurons, the one in 8 and the one in 12, and you see that when the interneurons are coordinated peristaltically, so are the motor neurons, and when the interneurons are coordinated synchronously, so are the motor neurons. So they switch and engage these things. And then a complete description, which I won't belabor here, of all the activity of every neuron in the network can be ascertained in this way and displayed in this way to show you the complete peristaltic and synchronous motor patterns. And then, of course, this is translated into constrictions of the heart. Here, in an intact preparation, we're recording from a motor neuron. We do this in two different segments, and we record the beating of the heart with a tension transducer, and every burst in the motor neuron causes a beat in the heart. And that coordinates the hearts, and that's shown here. With such a preparation, we recorded from the motor neuron in 12, the motor neuron in 8, the heart in 8, and the heart in 12. And you can see that for every burst in the motor neuron, there's a constriction in the heart. First, the hearts are coordinated peristaltically, and then at the switch, they're recorded, they're coordinated synchronously. So that all makes sense. So now something a little different. I wanted to show you another aspect of my lab, which is we've also taken a very biophysical approach. We've asked the question of what makes these two neurons, if I take an isolated ganglion and put it in a dish, they always produce this rhythm of activity. What makes them rhythmic? It's not obvious what should make them rhythmic. Okay, so what we did was we went in and we used a technique called voltage clamp to identify all the different types of ion channels that are in the membrane. And all these different types of ion channels have different functions. And they are activated by voltage, right? So action potentials are produced by voltage-sensitive or gated sodium channels and potassium channels. But there are other ion channels that are slower that control aspects like this. And we've put this all question? Oh, we put this all in a model. So here are the biological neurons. Here's our model. We make a model, and we put in it the biophysical data on all the different currents that we've identified. The fast sodium current that makes action potentials, a persistent sodium current, three different potassium currents that have different kinetics. This one's very fast, this one's very slow, this one's intermediate. I'll come back to this. Two different low threshold calcium currents, this one that's very fast and this one that's slow. And then this current, which is a special current, it's called the hyperpolarization activated current. Plus, in the model, we also put in the synaptic conductances between the two neurons because they have to inhibit one another. So let's look at some of these currents. This H current is in from the left cell here, and it is turned on not by depolarization of the membrane potential, but by hyperpolarization. And it produces the inward flow of positive charge, and that helps the cell recover from this cell's inhibition and come up and fire. That's called IH. Look at this one. This one is this low threshold calcium current. When the cell comes up to about this potential, this is the minus 50 line, then this current is activated and it produces a strong inward flow of positive charge, which depolarizes the cell and makes it fire lots of action potentials. But it slowly inactivates. That's why it's called slow. It inactivates. It self-terminates. Inactivation is a property of these channels. And it's slowly turning down, and that makes this neuron fire at a lower and lower frequency. You see how it fires very rapidly at first and it slowly dies out. So this cell is both escaping due to its H current and being released due to this current. And this model helped us to see that. So you should never be satisfied with being able to explain something with a model, because a model is not necessarily reality. If it went against what you saw, then you would know that you were thinking in the wrong way. But a positive result with a model is not anywhere near as strong as a negative result. So we had to go after this more carefully. So just to show you what my hypothesis is, I'm showing you the low threshold calcium current that slowly inactivates in this cell, and I'm showing you the H current that's in this cell. And you can see what's going on here. This is up in its burst. This current turns on, supports the burst, but gradually wanes. So the cell fires less and less, releasing this cell from inhibition. Meanwhile, this cell has its own way of escaping from inhibition, because the inhibition turns on this current, which brings the membrane potential back up. Okay, so just to remind you, we can record in two different ways. And I put this slide in there to emphasize the importance of this H current and to also show you a little bit of the primary data. So this is a voltage clamp experiment in which we were able to isolate the H current and study it. And you can see that when you step the membrane potential to a very negative value from minus 40, then you see this slow development of an inward current. And it's smaller when you step to a lower, not so hyperpolarized potential. Okay, so that's the kind of data we put into the model. And now here's a separate experiment in which we have two hard interneurons that are producing this activity, and we put on a peptide modulator called myomodulin. And you notice how much faster it makes it go. Do you see that? It makes it go a lot faster. So it bursts a lot faster. And what causes that to a large extent is that myomodulin turns up the H current. Notice there's more H current in the presence of myomodulin than there is in before myomodulin. So this has intrigued us and made us very interested in looking at this directly. So here's my hypothesis again, and now I'm going to define a couple of points that we wanted to make. One is what we call the final frequency. What is the final frequency? The final frequency is what is the interval between the last two action potentials at the end of a burst, right? So that's a measure of how strongly this guy can inhibit that guy, right? So that, because the faster this cell fires action potentials, the more it will inhibit that cell. And so that final frequency is very important. The other thing I'm going to tell you about is the period. The period is the time from the start of one burst to the start of another, right? So there are two measures: how fast the rhythm is going and what the final frequency is. So now here's the model now, and the model says this. It says that if you increase the amount of H current in the model, that the period of the oscillation will go down. Right? It goes faster, and the final frequency goes up. All right, let's go back and see how that might make sense. So if there's more of this current, then this cell can escape more easily, and so it can come up and fire at a different point on this guy's burst when its final frequency is higher, right? So that makes sense. And then we'll go ahead and look at this graph. And this graph, I'm really bad at this, I'm sorry. This graph shows that that if you increase, if you change the inactivation time constant, what is that? Let's look at that. So how fast this current turns itself off. So if I make the time constant bigger, then it will go more slowly, right? We can manipulate that in a model. It's very easy to do. And so we're changing that. And what we see in the model is that if we make that slower and slower, then the period gets longer and longer. But the final frequency does not change. Does not change. So it still releases the other cell at exactly the same point. All right? It just takes more time to get there. So how can you test this idea? The model says this is what works. How do you test it? So we test it by a technique that's called dynamic clamping. And we like to show it here. Here's one of the hard interneurons filled with a dye. And we made this fanciful axon that goes into a computer. So we're going to attach the neuron, the living neuron, to a computer. And in fact, to a computer model, a complete computer model of one of the hard interneurons that runs in real time. So it runs in real time. And remember that this is what the neurons normally do. And what we did here was we blocked the synapses between the two neurons with a chemical called bicuculine. And then we hooked up one of the neurons to what's called the dynamic clamp and a real-time system that will allow us to model one of the cells and to produce artificial synapses between these cells. And so here's the model hard interneuron, here's the living hard interneuron. Notice at the beginning they're both firing constantly because we've blocked the synapses. Now we turn on the synapse in the computer from this cell to the model cell. You see the inhibition starts here and there's like unpatterned activity. Now we turn on the synapse from the model cell to the living cell and they take off like that and start to burst. Okay? So they produce this alternating rhythm on and on and on like that. So this is what we call a hybrid system of a model and a living neuron. So what can you do with this? Well, we did experiments like this. So what we did was we changed the amount of conductance in the model neuron. You can do that. It's a computer, right? It's a computer model. You can change the amount of conductance, how many H channels there are. And when we have about two in there, then the two cells are very well balanced and they produce a certain period. Now, if we increase that to four, then the model cell recovers from inhibition more quickly. See that? And the period gets shorter. And notice that the burst duration of the living cell gets smaller, right? And the final frequency at which this cell can escape from this cell goes up. And that's what the graphs on the right show. And here, if we add more, we see an even bigger effect. And so here you would see the final frequency and how it varies with the amount of H current in the living neuron. And here you see the period with the amount of H current. Okay, so then you can do the other experiment. You can now use the dynamic clamp to artificially introduce into the living neuron more of this conductance. So we did that, and we got a corresponding result. Here, if you add a lot of extra conductance into the living neuron, it recovers from the inhibition of the other one more quickly. And the other one's burst duration goes down, and you have the same effect on final frequency. And then as a final experiment, we did this. We put in a blocker of the H current in the living neuron, and then we introduced the artificial conductance back into the living neuron. If we have no H current, then this is what you see, a very unbalanced oscillator with the model neuron firing for really long times and having to get to a very low final frequency before it releases the other cell. When we add back some into the living cell, we can balance it up so that their two are acting in a nice reciprocal way. And if we add even more, then we swing it in favor of the living neuron. And again, we have the same effect on the final frequency. Okay, so it's that kind of experiment that we do to verify our models. And we've also done the corresponding experiment. I can show you the data. I have it here, but I don't want to belabor it to a general audience. I have the slides here. We also did the corresponding experiment using dynamic clamp, which is to do this experiment, where we blocked the endogenous calcium current in the living neuron, and we added back a calcium current that where we could control how fast it inactivates. And we also did that in the model neuron, and we got the result that we anticipated, which is that there would be no change in the final frequency, but the period would increase. Okay, so this is the kind of experiment that we like to do. We like to go from the neuronal networks that we describe in detail to models that we run in a computer. We use the models to generate hypotheses for how the system works, and then we go back into the living system using dynamic clamp to test the ideas that we have. And I'll just end up with pictures of people in my lab, because they all were very important in this work. Michael Wright, my last graduate student, Brian Norris, my collaborator, and Angela Venning, my longtime collaborator in my lab. She's been working in my lab for over 15 years. And this is Shingis Gune. He's a computational person. He does all the modeling. And Anka Dolak-Mihu also is a modeler, does all the modeling. Here's Angela again. And Daniel Quay, who's been studying these oscillators. And what he's doing is actually starting to become very interesting. he's found that the sodium-potassium pump, which is in all neurons, which itself generates a current, is important in determining the rhythmicity of this system also. So he's been studying that. And of course, I have to thank the leeches because they give their bodies and souls for this research. All right, thank you. I hope I didn't go on too long. No, I think it's just right. Yep, go ahead.
So when you you showed the map of the connections between the neurons that you made in the NLP and XIDT, so how did you figure those out? Just by like recording from the neurons?
That's right. We record from the neurons, and what we do is, and we've done this systematically over the years, we've even measured the strength of every connection. And we've published the strength, so we know the relative strengths of all the connections. So what you do is you put an electrode in one cell, and you put an electrode in the other cell. And then you record their activity, and then you use a technique called spike-triggered. You put the postsynaptic cell in voltage clamp, and then you use a technique called spike-triggered averaging, where you average the currents for every spike, and then it shows you the synaptic current. I think I might have a picture of that in here somewhere. This is all Daniel's work here. No, I don't have it. I showed that in my last talk, but I don't have it. Sorry. And that's how we do it. So you have to do it by using this technique, a voltage clamp, and then the amount of current that you get in the postsynaptic cell tells you the strength of the connection.
What I wanted to know is, how do you isolate it from the rest of the neuron? I mean, how do you know that they're not affected?
Okay, so that's why you use this technique of spike-triggered averaging. Because what you're doing is you're asking, what are the synaptic currents that are associated with this cell's presynaptic spikes, right? That's it. Because if you remember the connection diagram, it's pretty complicated. Let's see if we can go back to it. It's pretty darn complicated. So just give you an example of, yeah, let's look here. So you can see that 3 inhibits 3, this 3 inhibits this 3 inhibits this 3, but it also gets inhibition from 1 and 2. So you see a lot of synaptic potentials in the postsynaptic cell. But we're only interested in what is the synaptic potential caused by this cell. So we record from that, and then we use this spike-triggered averaging technique to pull it out. And so we can say that, we can say categorically, that the 3-to-3 connection is very strong, but the 1 and 2-to-3 connection is relatively weak. And we've gone through and measured all of them and published that. So that it's in making, we have also a full model of this network, and so you need to know that stuff to make the network work right. Yes. Yeah, I suspect, I don't know how we would do that, but what we do know is that if you do something really silly like slice these two ganglia in half, that the two sides become totally uncoordinated from one another and everything is messed up. Okay, so that's actually, a question that's intrigued Angela. Angela is a real physiologist at heart. I'm more of a neurobiologist, and she's looked at the circulation. So What we know is that that the synchronous heart is putting, there's only one vessel that comes off the heart for outflow, and that goes to the nephridia. And the synchronous heart is putting blood into the nephridia, which are the kidneys. The peristaltic heart is propelling the blood throughout the entire rest of the circulation. And it carries a lot more blood because it's filled from the rear, whereas the synchronous heart is only filled within each segment. And so we think that the animal is perfusing the nephridia first on one side, then on another, like that. And we also have measured the systolic and diastolic pressure within the hearts, and we know the synchronous heart is the real mover because it has very high systolic pressure, whereas the peristaltic heart has very low systolic pressure. So, you know, it's kind of like left heart, right heart in humans, where the left ventricle is the real powerhouse. Oh, absolutely. I mean, for the, you know, the breathing rhythm is the most well understood of all the central pattern generators. And there we know exactly the neurons that control the breathing rhythm. But still, you know, there are five or six groups in the United States that are at each in one another's throats on exactly how it works. It's a very competitive area because it's extremely important medically. Extremely important. I mean, the breathing rhythm, without it, forget about it, right? The walking rhythm, as I showed, is now being studied in a number of different places. Martin Goulding at UCSD has been really the leader in using genetic techniques to identify classes of neurons in the mouse, neonatal mouse spinal cord, to look at this pattern generator. And as I said, they can take the thing out and put it in a dish. And Ulla Keen at the Karolinska Institute in Stockholm is the other big leader in looking at this. So that's been, and in zebrafish, there are a number of labs that are working on the central pattern generator for swimming. Abdel El-Manira in Stockholm at the Karolinska, and David McLean at Northwestern in Chicago are the two labs that come to mind as being the ones who are really studying this. And they have a simpler pattern generator. And what's interesting about what the zebrafish, what's really, really interesting about the zebrafish and why I'm more excited about it than the mouse is that remember that we think that, you know, limbed vertebrates evolved from fish-like ancestors. So how are the same neurons reprogrammed to produce limbed locomotion? So you know you can identify neurons now in vertebrates by the transcription factors that they express, right? And so we know the corresponding neurons for some of the classes in both zebrafish and mouse. And you know which transcription factors are there. So by studying how these neurons are used for axial locomotion, where you undulate like this, versus limbed locomotion, it is really going to be pretty exciting, I think. So I think there's a lot of things ahead. If I were going to start over again at this point, I probably would work in zebrafish spinal cord. But you know, at the time that I started, zebrafish spinal cord, no, nothing. Now I'm working on fruit flies. I mean, what's more ridiculous than that? Well, I hope that you enjoyed yourself, at least.